Hey everyone, it's episode 405 of the 343 podcast. Today is all about pressing. How do you train a team? How do you train the players to press? Press the ball. And it's not just a matter of rah, 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 let's go, Johnny, go and press the ball. Everybody put in your maximum effort. Has something to do with it. But the most important thing is it's a matter of choreography. It's a matter of actually training how to press. Critical things for all you coaches and everybody, frankly, to know out there. Whether it be the little ones in the recreational environment, the intermediate youth level, or at the super elite youth level all around the world, including the best academies in the world, choreography is key. You're going to learn a lot about that today. And also, I should mention, Benny asked me a question. He's like, hey, Gary, if people want to learn more about this pressing business, who should they be looking at the international level? And I kind of shocked him with the answer because I told him the U.S. men's national team. Shocking, because I never recommend basically watching either MLS or the U.S. men's national team. It's always criticism from me for very good reason. And my remark was said before this international window, before the U.S. men's national team played Paraguay and Uruguay. And look what happened. Yeah, the results speak for themselves. And I gotta say, we get it right here on 343 100% of the time. Wink, wink. So if you're a coach and you want to get things right 100% of the time as well, wink, wink, you go to 343coaching.com. That is where we have our coaching education platform, where there's free and premium programs for you there. We sponsor ourselves, ladies and gentlemen. We don't accept sponsors from the outside because we believe in what it is that we've done, as evidenced by the pioneering work of my brother, Brian Kleiben, who helped transform the American soccer youth landscape. Today's episode was all about pressure. So you're going to get all the pressure exercises on that platform if you sign up right away. The whole methodology is there, from rondos to building out of the back to transitioning into the midfield to transitioning into offensive patterns. The whole thing is available to you at 343coaching.com. And parents, the same goes for you. You go to 343masterclass.com, and that is where you're going to develop a discerning eye, a more discerning eye for what the heck is happening with your son or daughter in the youth soccer landscape here in America. It's important that you become a very good mentor to them and a guide for them. Last but not least, if you're coaching in the 7v7 format, you go to 7v7coaching.com. So last time, guys, coaches, you go to 343coaching.com. Parents, you go to 343masterclass.com. And the little ones, you go to 7v7coaching.com. All right, everybody, I hope you enjoy this episode. Here we go.
I want to talk about a topic today that I'm particularly interested in because I know it'll help me as a coach as well. And I know it'll help other coaches as well. The press, Gary. The art of the press. Not the press, the puppet media, right? The press on the actual field of your actual players. How to teach it. What does it look like? What types of things can you do in training? So many things that we can get into. Okay, so before we start talking about how to teach it and how to coach it, it's well known, Gary, that within 343, the system is a possession-based system, right? But you also emphasize pressing. And I know that you guys have modeled your teams after Marcelo Bielsa's Chile. I think the other one was Diego Simeone's Atletico Madrid. What led to you guys identifying these teams? And then not only that, saying, okay, this is exactly how we want a team to play. Because obviously there's been successful coaches that don't emphasize high press, right? Maybe they're sitting in a mid block or a low block and they choose to counter, right? So what is it about the high press that was so appealing to you guys? And you're like, you know what? This is what we're going to run and we're going to stick to it.
Yeah. Let's see. So earliest memories is watching Argentine football, the Argentine first division. And look, we were super young, so it's not like we were there tactically deciphering what's going on, even though I've said repeatedly what it is that we would always do, right? Is tape record things and then pause, rewind, watch again, pause, rewind, watch again, and try to deconstruct stuff. But we were still young kids, preteens and into our teens. And so you don't have that sort of level of sophistication necessarily to see what is a high press, what is a low block, what is a mid block. All these sorts of terminologies didn't really exist as far as I know. Okay. At least not to the degree that it is today. But in watching those matches, Benny, in the first division of Argentina, the intensity was just so high that pressure was almost a given. Was it choreographed? I don't know. I doubt it. I think it was more a mentality sort of thing, like let's go get them and let's get the ball back, more than anything structural or tactical like it is now. But I think that was probably the first inspiration of aggression and defense. Okay. And because the slide tackles were also absolutely vicious. I mean, the English like to, I keep ripping on the English, but I'm sorry, but the English like to say, oh, get stuck in, lad. And, but bro, compared to the Argentines with studs up, it was a cakewalk. Okay. In England. So I think those were my first memories. And then along came Bielsa, of course. And when Bielsa took over the Argentine national team, that's, I think, the biggest trigger of them all, because he took what I just described and made it pro. You know what I mean? So if what I was watching was amateur, Bielsa really elevated it to the next level. And there it was, choreographed for sure. How it was trained, I don't know. That is more a question for Brian, because, you know, part of Brian's story is him going watching Bielsa train down when it was in the Copa America and in other places. You know, he would sneak into the stadium and kind of pretend to be a security guard and get a security jacket from a security guard and then just sneak right on into the stadium and then just sit his ass down and either take little notes or mental notes of what was going on. So Bielsa, of course, is huge in that regard. And I think Brian modeled his teams after Bielsa's teams more than anything else. And then, of course, came Pep's Barcelona. And Pep's Barcelona took it to a whole other level. And that is when I think the distribution of information was so much greater with the internet at that point, that a lot of what Pep was teaching really made its way out into the quote-unquote mainstream, but it wasn't really mainstream still. It was still kind of an obscure thing. Things like the choreography in pressing, number one. Things like looking for training to look for particular triggers in the opponent, and then that sparks the pressing. Or philosophies like, hey, well, if I press high up the field, obviously I'm making the field not as stretched, so it's very difficult for the other opponent to actually play. And if we win it, and we're all basically pressing in packs, if we win it, your teammate is right there 5 or 6 yards away from you, or 10 yards away from you, versus 20, 30, or 40 yards away from you. So once you recover the ball under that sort of Pep Guardiola press, it's easy to then touch out of it and retain possession. And then you're off to the races into the offense. So I think it went like that, Benny. The Argentine First Division to Bielsa to Pep Guardiola.
Was I incorrect, Gary? I feel like I read in one of your blogs or something about Diego Simeone's Atletico Madrid. Like, weren't they notorious for their pressing as well? And you guys kind of modeled it a little bit after him?
I think him as a player, yes. Him as a coach, not as much. Certainly not to the influence that I just mentioned. Because Simeone was more, even during Atletico Madrid, obviously, his 13-year career in Atletico Madrid as a coach, I don't know how long it's been at this point. His is more, especially when playing against the tough opponents, more like bunkering, okay? Mm. And then it's the transition from defense to offense that is a million miles per hour, you know, and the counterattack is a million miles per hour. So I think maybe that's what I was referring to, unless I'm mistaken, and this is like a blog post from 15 years ago and something has changed. But I don't think so, Ben. I think Simeone's defensive mentality is something we really admire. And when we would train to bunker, and yes, ladies and gentlemen, we would train the teams on how to park the bus and bunker and counter, because at times you run up against teams that are superior to you. So when Brian's teams was playing 1 year up or 2 years up, not a player, the entire team was playing a year up or 2 years up, and not at some rec level. At the highest level of the land, he was playing against the top teams a year or two up. Then sometimes you make a decision. You're like, okay, let's sit, let's wait a bit. And when we get it, we go. But that was more with the girls' team, Benny, than the guys' team, because the guys' team is just a different animal. With the girls' team, you were overmatched on a regular basis.
Yeah, and they were still successful, though. Gary, youth soccer, I think, is completely different in the sense that, like, if you look at the pro game, college, even high school, like you're going to oftentimes find footage of the team that you're going to play before the game, right? And so as a coach, you can see, okay, this is how the team is going to build out. Are they going to go direct, right? Are they going to go to their left or right center back every time? And so in training, I think it's a little bit easier to rehearse because you know, okay, this is exactly how it's going to be. But in the youth game, Gary, the first time that you ever see the team play most of the times is when you show up on the weekend, game one of league, right? So as a coach in youth soccer, right, what is the best way to have your team be organized? Because obviously every team is different. Some teams build out of the back, some teams go direct, right? There's a lot of different styles. In the training session though, Gary, how would it look for the coach that's trying to help this team? If they want to be a high pressing team, you know, what are the things that they should be working on in training? And how do you get it to be choreographed, right? And not just like in youth soccer, you see it a lot of like one kid just running his head off and the other kids are clueless. It's just really unorganized, right? So how can you get them to be a more cohesive pressing group together?
Yeah. So let's start with the, kind of like the earliest ages or the lowest of levels. And let's pretend that the team is not sophisticated at this at all. Okay. So from scratch, I think something Brian, you know, deployed with his teams was in place of the opponent, you place cones as representative or flags as representative of the opponent and the opponent's position. So you would deploy the cones or deploy the flags and say, okay, here's their right back, their right center back, their left center back, their left back. If you're playing 11v11, if you're playing 7v7, 9v9, obviously you would manipulate it accordingly. And then you place the cones and the flags to illustrate all their player positions. And then you line up your front three. Okay, let's say you're going to press with your front three. And the front three, without a ball, without anything, you can integrate this with your fitness as well. Brian would just signal, okay, their two has the ball, you know, and the players already have to learn the numbering system. You know, what is a two? What is a three? What is a five? What is all those sorts of things? But for the folks out there who may not know the numbering system, Brian might yell out, hey, right back. And then the front three, you know, our right winger would go and press the right back. Oh, sorry, I'm inverted here. If their right back has it, it's our left winger that goes and presses immediately. And then the other two guys who would be the center forward and the right winger, they would go and to their appropriate spots. It's not like everybody goes to the same player who has the ball, is simulating to have the ball. The center forward would then drive to try to cut off the passing lane for the right back. And then the right winger would tuck in and go forward, anticipating maybe the right back is going to give it to their center back. So he's already going in case that happens. So you see the whole structure, Benny, right? Shift to whoever Brian is saying has the ball on the opponent's side. And it's all in unison. And all the players who are pressing are preserving a certain spacing accordingly. But the key thing for the player not pressing the ball is to cut off passing lanes because... And Brian's very smart about this. Before the team even gets there, he might switch it up on them. Oh, center back now, right? Simulating that their right back gave the ball to the center back already before the press even got to where they were supposed to get. And then they're supposed to systematically go to their corresponding pressing positions, Benny. So this is how you start out. To help the younger kids, you can even lay out a certain type of cone, colored cone, to tell exactly your players where you're supposed to be when you go press the left back, the center back, the right back. So I kind of botched that up a bit. It's been so long since I've communicated it, but that's essentially what's going on. I think the audience kind of gets it.
Okay, so pay attention. First round of greens, blues. If you don't know what's going on, you should be paying attention. We're gonna rehearse half speed greens, half speed. So I'm gonna call green. What's gonna happen, Uli? Misa, what's gonna happen? Jonah, what's gonna happen? Keep going, Misa. Keep going to right inside the blue cone. Right inside the blue guy. Good. I'm going to call the red guy. The left back has it. Jonah pressures. Misa pressures. Efra, you're on the green. Good. Alice, you're on the blue. Uli shifting. Good. I'm going to call that blue center back. Who's on it? Right there. You're good, Uli. Good, Jonah. I'm going to call green. What's up, Uli? Good, Misa. Good, Jonah. Efra, all the way here. All the way. And I'm going to say home. When I say home, we're jogging back because they played a long ball. We're going to win the second ball and you're going to get it. Okay? Home, jogging, home. Did you notice how everybody looks like one unit together moving at the same time?
Yeah.
It works. It looks good. Now, if we have just one guy pressuring and the other four watching, it doesn't work. That's why we're so successful. We move together as one unit. It's five of you, but really it's one. Green is up. How the green works together. Left back, red, go. Green, full speed, Uli. Red, get there. Blue behind you, Misa, the other blue. Green, get there, Uli. Home. Good.
Yeah. One thing I also notice within the attacking patterns is that after a player would finish, I believe Brian would call it a number and like blow the whistle, and then they immediately have to sprint to get back into their pressing areas, right? So I think that's another big one to add. But Gary, I know you haven't given this much thought as well, but in the youth game, like from I think it's U6 to U9, there's also the build out line now. So
sure.
You know? So you're gonna have to think about, I don't know, it's different starting positions or
the principles are the same. Okay, so they implemented some lame ass rule, the build out line. Okay, you can't go press until the ball passes. Okay, so now you just operate within that new framework. Hey, team, when the other team passes, you know, crosses this threshold, this is how we're going to press, and you choreograph it.
Yeah. I know, Gary, you said for some teams, you guys would sit back when, and I know it was rare with the boys, but was this decided before the game, Gary, or is this like a mid-game adjustment that happens?
Before the game, and you train it. You don't just tell your players, oh, hey, let's park the bus, as if your players are going to know what the hell you're even talking about. No, you absolutely train it, and it's all choreographed to the point where, hey, when our goalkeeper gets the ball, we're in a low block, we're parking the bus, right? And let's say that the other team serves the ball in the box and our goalkeeper gets the ball. We choreograph, okay, how do we counter immediately with the goalkeeper? And the goalkeeper is taught, this is the outlet, or these are the two options or the outlets that you're going to be looking for. If our team is sprinting down the right wing, you know, to gain advantage, you launch it immediately and catch the other team off guard.
Right. When would you deploy a mid block versus a low block, Gary? You know?
I think it depends on the level of dominance of the other team, in my opinion. And I also think it depends on, I was going to say the player profiles of the other team, but I'm thinking in particular who their star player is or star players are. If they have one star player, let's say their star player is their center mid. Okay. Well, we don't want to give that guy any space. We want to smother him immediately. We don't want to let him think. So we don't go into a low block. We go into a mid block so that we congest the middle of the field a lot more. That just one scenario. But most of the time, we weren't saying low, mid, high block. We were talking about lines of confrontation. I'm sure our audience have heard that before. When the other team crosses this particular line, that is when we start confronting them. So maybe the line of confrontation, to make it simple, might be the halfway line. So if the halfway line is the line of confrontation, okay, now we're talking about a mid block sort of thing, because you already have your front line starting to press them, bite their ankles when they cross the halfway line. If the line of confrontation is 10 yards deep into your territory, okay, now we're talking about a low block. And I just think it depends, Benny, on the other team's level of skill and capability is what you decide, how low you have to go. Sometimes if the opponent is so good, you actually don't have a choice. They force you into a low block because they're just that good. You'll try to confront them a little bit higher up the field, but they'll just skip right by you. And all of a sudden that forces you to go back. And interestingly enough, during the Berhalter era, and even when we look at some MLS games, even though MLS is, I don't even want to bring up MLS because it's so bad, but I'll say it anyway. You would get all this analysis during a U.S. men's national team game or after a U.S. men's national team game by the pundits, by the media, saying, oh yeah, you know, they decided to go into a low block or mid block. And like, bitch, no, Colombia forced you to fucking, you didn't want to do that. You actually were trying to press them. You were actually trying to press them high up the field, but it would not work. So you were literally, the players were forced to retreat and get into a shell. And it wasn't rehearsed. You can tell when it's rehearsed.
Yeah. So Gary, on that note, because I was just going to ask you, I know you said that the mid block, the low block, it's all orchestrated, right? You rehearse it in training. Most coaches, okay, let's say you have a 7v7 team, right? Maybe you have 10 or 11 players on the roster. How can you orchestrate it at training to where that it's like, is it the same as the pressing one where it's just you call it a number and they all ship to the space? Or because I know when I've seen videos of Brian training it, right? The press, the build out, he has like 20 guys out there, so he can kind of simulate a match environment, right? But yeah, if you only have 11 guys on your roster, and then you're okay, you're only going to have 3v7, right? Which is not the most game realistic. So
yeah,
how do you work around that?
No, well, it's tough, and I don't think it's that big a deal, because in my opinion, when you're playing 7v7 or 8v8 or 9v9, when you're in those territories, you're talking about the very young players, and there's so many things that the young players need to learn that are more important, things like on the ball, in possession, and that takes up all of your time that today, if I were coaching, I wouldn't even bother. Okay, we're going to train how to defend in a mid block or in a low block. That is just such a waste of time for their development, for the team's development, for the coach's development, in my opinion. So I wouldn't even bother. I would only do the high press. I would only do when we lose the ball, you know, how do we react to that? And that's it insofar as kind of the pressing sort of defensive organization work. Everything else is with the ball. My opinion, again, maybe I'm wrong. Now, if somebody wants to do what you just described, well, it's a little challenging. Ben, it's a little challenging. Hopefully you have an assistant coach. So you, the coach, the assistant coach, and maybe you get your goalkeeper or your goalkeeper and a defender or something, you can actually be the opponent and you don't have to run it through it at full speed. You can just literally say, organize ourselves, and then I pass it to my assistant passes it to my goalkeeper, we're simulating the opponent, right? And then I'm verbally instructing how to defend these things, how to press, how to, you know, shift, how to choreograph. But I wouldn't do it, Benny. Do you agree, or would you?
No, I agree.
Do you have ideas?
I agree, but then I was even thinking like some 11v11 teams that are a little bit older, right? They still only have maybe 15 or 16 players on the roster.
And that's enough. That's enough in my opinion, because then you can just eliminate get the back line of the defensive team, and they don't participate on the defensive side really, because you're working on the pressing more than anything. You use them to be the opponent.
Yeah. I think it was Bielsa who's like notorious for separating his trainings, meaning that he would take like the attacking front five, right? The three forwards, the two attacking mids, he would train them all separately. And then he'd take the midfielders, and then the back line, and then at the end of the week, it would all become cohesive. Obviously, that's not ideal for most club coaches in the U.S. because you don't have the time and space, and right. But I think if there is a possibility to do that, to isolate the groups, I think that's a massive help, dude.
Because massive. Then you can
spotlight in on them and focus on those.
Massive. Just think about, it's basically personal training.
Yeah,
for it's super special. It's the best, man. It is the absolute. Luckily, Brian was able to do that on a number of occasions, and especially when there was a big game coming up, and you really needed to focus in on the functional stuff as well. Give a little rehearsal of how we're going to do things. You would go through that exercise and then bring the whole group together.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Or especially for, sorry, I know you want to talk about defense and pressing, but especially for finishing, that's more the most important thing of all, finishing. They have to be in isolation, because especially if they don't train on their own, Ben, the strikers are shocking, shocking. They'll miss sitters.
Yeah, 100%. Can you talk a little bit, Gary, about pressing triggers? Maybe, you know, what it is for people that haven't heard about it. And then what were the most common ones that you guys would use when playing?
Yeah, the most common are the other team trying to build out. And the most common from that is off of a goal kick. Obviously, there's the build out line for the youngers, so let's throw that out the window. But that is the most common trigger. We would identify the weakest player on their team, left back or right back. And then on a goal kick, we kind of flood the opposite side so that the goalkeeper lays it to the weak guy. And then as soon as he does that, okay, the press is on. And it's massive choreography to smother that guy, and he's going to have to launch it forward. He has no, or lose it. He's going to have no choice. So that's number one. Number two also dealt with the line of confrontation as well. So, and it was choreographed. Hey, when this particular player on the field gets into this area, that triggers us and we all go. It's as simple as that. It doesn't have to be that complicated. The major rehearsal is deep in their territory.
Right. And something that you also said is like flooding the field to one side to force them, like commonly known as traps, no? Like setting traps for the other team. So was that a big part of it too?
It's like, yeah, massive. Hey,
we recognize that their six is absolutely shocking. Let's funnel our wingers to mark the outsides. The nine, you mark the center back. So let's get the ball to the six and turnovers galore, you know?
Massive, massive. And I know people are going to get triggered here, but what else is new? Let's say that their D mid is not shocking, but not great. I don't know. Maybe he's even a great player. Okay. They're six. We would say, I'd be yelling on the sideline, hey, let the six have it. He's shocking, you know? And but we'll set the trap so that the six gets it, or we'll set the trap so that the right back gets it. But while we're setting the trap, or before we set the trap, we're like, let them give it to this guy. He's so bad. So when they give it to him, the kid is even more nervous. We're not doing this to 10-year-olds, ladies and gentlemen. Okay. We're talking 15, 16, 17-year-olds.
Did you see somebody's comment, Gary, that they were like going through the episode and they're like, oh, like Gary's called somebody a bitch. Okay, I'll take another minute. And at the end of the, oh, Gary called an imaginary 10-year-old kid a cunt. Got it. Noted, bro.
These people, man, so sensitive. Little snowflakes, for sure.
For sure. How much time, Gary, is spent on the pressing? Right? Because you obviously, as a coach with your team, you can't just run one training or two trainings. So is it a topic that gets revisited every month? Or is it, hey, the team has been pressing great the past couple of games, we don't need to work on it? Or maybe the press has been shocking, so let's spend more time on it. How does that look?
Yeah. Well, obviously you have to get them up to a level where they're actually doing it in matches. So, I mean, once they start doing it in matches, and yes, we have to joystick in matches because players forget. They just out there in la-la land and the game's happening and they should be pressing and they're not pressing. So, you know, you say something. You're like, hey, we're pressing, right? So it has to get to the point where upon your cue, they actually execute properly. And even better, if you don't even have to cue it, they start doing it on their own. What does it take to get there? I mean, if you have a brand new team, you should probably be rehearsing it once a week. And I don't know how long it's going to take, Benny. So one training session out of the week, maybe it's a 20-minute thing in that training session. And hopefully, you know, 5 weeks later, five matches later, they're kind of getting it. Because this is not as difficult as possessing the ball. Right. This is literally just deciding to run to a particular location and, you know, trying to get the ball off the other team. That really requires minimum technique, minimum tactical, minimum everything, Ben. So if in five matches they're not getting it, then something's up, dude. I don't know what it is. But once they kind of get it, you don't do that shit anymore unless you're kind of pissed on the weekend, like, what the fuck? The team doesn't even press anymore. This week is all pressing. The entire week. We don't do anything else. We're just doing pressing.
Yeah. What if you have a team, Gary, that's like, okay, let's say you get a brand new team and their fitness level is shocking, right? Meaning they're physically not capable of pressing the opponent for the entire game. Like, for example, I've seen teams where like, I'm like, wow, this team is fucking great at pressing. And then at halftime, they come back on the field and they're fucking dead, dude. You know, so do you have to kind of evaluate your team and say like, okay, obviously right now we're not fit enough. Maybe we do just sit back a little bit and counter, right?
I agree.
You got to recognize your players, man. And those games when I've seen those teams, it's like, oh shit, like these guys are running their ass off, like we're fucked. And then they come back out at halftime and they're fucking jogging, you know, because they're exhausted.
Yeah, no, I agree. And it's part of your management. You know, you have to be able to recognize the fitness levels of individuals and the team. And then you just, people call it joysticking, but it's not joysticking. You literally give them instructions and you say, hey, we chill for like 5-10 minutes or something. Misa, catch your breath. Or you can you know, relax for the next 5-10 minutes. Let them come at us a little bit. That and substitutions, Benny. I mean, I don't know what else to do, but I know exactly what you're talking about. It happens at all the levels, even the highest levels, especially if the other team is successful in playing out of your press, then that's a massive problem. If they're just, you're pressing, you're running your balls off and they just touch it around you, you're not going to last very long, 15 minutes max.
Yeah, for sure. And I think you got to incorporate some of that, the John Esham fitness into your sessions, bro. So,
Of course. I didn't know if you wanted to, for us to go there or not, but that's absolutely true. Folks here have a cow. Oh, you're doing stuff without the ball and fitness. No, you can incorporate ball into fitness. And even if you're not incorporating the ball into a 10-minute fitness session, so be it. That's fine. And ladies and gentlemen, don't be such, I'm trying to find the right insult. Don't be such a, I don't know what. Fitness is not a bad word. It's not a bad word. And don't start focusing in on children who barely even know how to formulate a sentence. I'm not talking about a 7-year-old, okay? I'm talking about competitive soccer here. I'm talking about competitive soccer. For all you folks out there who think you have a kid who is in competitive soccer, fitness should not trigger you. If fitness triggers you, that means you're not in competitive soccer or your mentality is not of the competitive nature.
Would you say, Gary, that for the most part, every one of Brian's sessions had fitness in it, right? Some type
I'd say
of,
so.
Whether it be before the session and the activation, at the end, even like hidden fitness, right? Even the pressing example that we talked about, right? Where you call out the numbers, like that in a way is kind of hidden fitness because the players don't realize they're getting 15, 20 sprints in a row, right? So, but I think, you know, going back and watching all of his sessions, there was fitness in every single session that I've seen. So a lot of people say like, oh, like, why are you making your kids run? Like, bro, they're fucking, you're running in soccer, you know? Or the players complaining like, coach, why do we have to run today? What the fuck? You have to run in the game. If you can't run right now for 20 minutes, how are you expected to last 90 minutes? There's no way.
Yeah, and it impacts technique and it impacts decision-making. How are you going to get better technically if you get tired in 10, 15 minutes of a match or 15 minutes of a match? Then all of a sudden, your touch starts degrading immediately if your fitness level isn't there. So you actually aren't developing your technique if you're tired all the time. You also aren't developing your soccer IQ, your tactical acumen, your decision-making. If you get tired after 10, 15 minutes, your brain, your body isn't focused on the football, really. You're focused on how tired you are. So you get mental fog as a consequence. So you need to have a fit player and a fit team to actually develop the players and develop the team.
Right. Okay. One of my favorite activities that we did when I was a player is Brian would have like a massive circle. We'd have half the team on the inside, half on the outside, blow the whistle. And for 2 minutes, right, you're sprinting to go and find a new station. But at the same time, working on your touch, right? So the guys on the outside would, you check in, they play you the ball, take two touches, jog. And then when you find an open station, you sprint, like kind of recreating the game, right? Where it's you're jogging, you find a new spot. You're sprinting, you're awesome, but it's fucking exhausting, right? And then at the end, he blows the whistle. You have to sprint out, do some like agility cones, and you come back in. And I remember he would always say, like, you should be fucking exhausted coming out of the middle. And that means you're working hard, you know? But when we're kids, you don't really see that as fitness. You're like, oh shit, this is fun. Like, getting touches on the ball, competing against my teammates. So that was a really good one. I like them. Do you remember that one?
100%, man. It's one of the best ones there is. One of the best ones there is, man. It's part of losing your man, too, because you would have somebody marking you and you have to shake them. So you're going slow, 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 like faking this way and then going to check into the ball on the left. It has to be a sprint. Otherwise, the guy's on your ass. It was awesome, man. Brilliant. There's so many integrations that were done, even in the rondos. So if you have particular number of players, if you say you're doing a 4v1 rondo and there's two guys on the outside, you know, waiting like their turn, because sometimes the numbers are uneven, right, Benny? And you can't have three full rondos operating with every player integrated. If somebody, the team who loses the ball or something like that, you have to, okay, abandon the rondo and make a full effort sprint around the field while the next group goes into the rondo, you see? And by the time you come back, okay, the other team probably lost it or is about to lose it, and then you're going to hop back into the rondo. So it's just constant, nonstop action, and it makes competitive spirit. It forces you to not lose the ball because you don't want to go and sprint around the field.
Yeah, that one sounds intense. I never seen that one.
Yeah, dude. And the strikers, you didn't see me working with the strikers very often, but it was all fitness work too, because you have to get the strikers fit. And also, you can't practice really finishing at a high level if you're totally rested. Like and the ball's not even moving, you're totally rested, you can focus, you take all your time in the world to finish, practice a shot. No, man, you got to be huffing and puffing as if it's the 80th minute of a game and you're dying, and here comes the one opportunity you're going to get, you know, as a cross into the penalty box, and you have to focus and make good contact and finish the fucking play. So in all the striking activities, it was all fitness related. If you blow a shot, you have to sprint and go get your ball before you can take another, you have, and bring it back. And when you bring it back, there's already a play in motion for you to actually get on the end of the play.
Yeah. One more, Greg, because fuck, there's so many, bro. But another one of my favorites, and I run this with my teams on, they love it too, is whether it's a small-sided game, right? Whether it's 3v3, 4v4, and you set up all the balls on the outside of the grid, right? If a player kicks a ball, let's say they shoot it and it goes fucking 50 yards away, the player has to sprint to go get the ball, put it back around. Meanwhile, the other team is countering, right? So there's literally no rest, bro. And I saw Brian do that when it was like when he would get together, like all the guys after they had gone on to go pro and they just get together and do some training. I saw him run that, and bro, it was like the most intense small-sided game I've ever seen, dude. It was sick.
Bro, I invented that game at Garden Hill Park. No, I swear to you, you think I'm joking. I'm not joking. I invented that game at Garden Hill Park. We were probably 16, 17. I don't know, because on a weekly basis, we would have pickup games there. Whole bunch of friends and people come on over. It could have been 2v2, 3v3, 4v4. Sometimes there were massive games, 6v6. And yeah, we didn't have goals with nets or anything. So what would we do? We would like put two shoes next to each other, maybe 3 yards apart or 2 yards apart or 1 yard apart, or maybe it was a trash can or whatever. And those were the goals. And hey, man, like if you're going to shoot, make sure kind of it's on target, because if you miss, You have the, whoever missed has to go and sprint and get the ball. And then your team is, a man down, because another ball gets thrown into play and you're screwed. So imagine if you're trying to slam a ball into the goal to get it past the defense, the ball could go 40, 50 yards. So your team is down a man for, 40 seconds, and you come back and you're dead.
Yeah, for sure. It's also a sure way to never lose a ball as a coach, bro. I've lost like 100 balls, bro, because they go into the bushes or balls get left eye. So never lose a ball like that, bro. Now, anytime I play small sided, that's a rule, dude.
Yeah. And you know why I invented that rule or how it came about? So when we would put two shoes next to each other and not that far apart, literally people would, and I invented this one too, right? At the pickup games, you just get right in front of the goal and kind of like block the whole fucking goal when somebody's attacking you. So it's almost impossible to score. And so what people ended up starting doing is like, okay, you want to get in the goal? What? Right? Just blast the ball at you. Just blast the ball. And when you do that, obviously the ball goes 50, 100 yards downfield. So when you invent that rule, then you have to think twice.
Yeah. No, I like that. Back to the press, Gary. Within the 343 coaching education platform, I think there's a couple of videos on pressing, but there's one in particular, the midfield three press, right? And so there's team of three on one side, team of three on the other side. Everybody has their own channel, right? Let's say the ball's with the middle channel. You obviously, the guy in the middle wants to go in step and everybody shifts cover balance, right? But if you look at a midfield three, Gary, most of the times you're not going to see like them just staying in a line of three. Okay, so what is the biggest objective of that? Like, what is it that you're trying to accomplish with that one? Is it pressing cover and balance, right, to deny crossing lanes? Is that basically the main objective of it?
Reaction time, one. So as soon as the ball gets transported into your zone, your reaction time, to immediately go and press is number one. So building that muscle memory, and then building the muscle memory of the remaining two guys or midfielders or whatever to, my guy's pressing over there. I need to cover and balance the rest of it. And to, what you said, because the purpose is to cover passing lanes at that point.
Right.
That's all it is. It's building that muscle memory.
Yeah. Did you guys invent that drill, or is that something that...
No. I don't know where that came from.
I've seen a lot of coaches start doing that, and over the course of time. And I think it's really beneficial. But not only that, it's competitive, and the players enjoy doing it too. It's like making it a fucking a war, basically. It's like, all right, you guys are on this team. If you get scored on, the next three come in. But I've seen a lot of teams and coaches start to do that activity as well.
And there's a lot of subtlety involved, because the remaining two guys who aren't pressing, they're supposed to cover and balance, right? And cover the passing lanes. And that kind of trains you, and you learn to not cheat in the game either.
Yeah.
Because if you try to cheat, you're going to get punished, right? You're going to cheat a little bit because the pass is going to come in your lane. And so you're already trying to go and press before the ball is even coming into your passing lane. And if you cheat, well, then you're not covering the passing lane, and the other team, gets their point.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. That's always what I'm yelling at my players is like, fucking punish them. If they're going to cheat, then take advantage of the passing lane that's open and get them off the field.
For sure.
How do you train, Gary, like the repress, right? Obviously your team loses the ball. The objective is win it back as quick as you can. Is a big part of that come from the rondos, or is it like, where do the players get the biggest influence for that?
Yeah, there's all kinds of transition rondos that can be done. One that I like a lot, and it's not strictly about the repress necessarily, and it's a bigger space, so it simulates the game a little bit better. I think what we had done on the platform is 5v5v5, if I'm not mistaken. And the team that, how did it go? Let's see.
Is that the one where there's two teams in the middle, one team on the outside, and the outside guys are neutrals? And
yeah,
if you lose
that's
the ball,
it.
You shrink, right? You win
that's
the ball.
It, that's it. That's it. That's it. So the team, when you get dispossessed, you're supposed to shrink the space, right? Immediately compress it, collapse it. And then when you regain possession, you're supposed to expand it out again, obviously, because if you want possession, you need good spacing. And if you want the other team not to possess, you want them to have crappy spacing. So that sort of transition, doing this sort of thing in and out, I liked a lot. But there are other rondos that are very compact that force you to get on defense instantaneously too, man.
Yeah, no, there's one, Gary, that I really enjoy, but like everybody and their mom does this one, bro. It's where there's three teams and there's like
4v4 plus three.
No. It's like, there's like a river in the middle. They call it the river, right? One team is on one side, one team's on the other. Ball gets played into a team, and then the team that's in the river, they send two guys. They press, right? If the team in possession loses the ball, then immediately like two of their guys sprint to the other box and they step up into the river and try and deny them to get the other team across. But I think that one's really good in terms of like the transition, right? From offense to defense. If your team loses the ball, especially if you're the one that lost it, you better be sprinting your ass off into the next box to go and get it.
Yeah.
But again, dude, I don't know where that activity came from, but I see everybody doing it. Do you know which one I'm talking about, or did I not explain
it? No, I know exactly what you're talking about. I know exactly what you're saying. Brian would do it, but not as often.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah, of course. I don't know why it reminded me of, because they were unsuccessful. Do you remember this very famous clip? I think it was when Barcelona beat Madrid 5-0. I think it was this game. And it's on the observer side on the right, and Ronaldo's pressing and Luka Modric is pressing, and like everybody's pressing Barca, and Barca's just constantly touching out of it. Ta, 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 and the crowd's going wild. And then they get, you know, obviously Madrid gets fed up and pissed. And then they go to the other side and the same shit happens on the other side. I don't know. It's just reminded me of that thing, because if it's not choreographed, then the chances of success are very low. And I'm not saying that Madrid doesn't choreograph things. Of course they do. But in the game, in that moment, it wasn't choreographed. It was just pissed off Madrid players, like pissed, and just each individually going mad after the ball. And that just made it easy for Barca to go, oh, bing, 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 I'm out.
Yeah, well, think about it, Gary. If you're in the middle of a rondo and your teammates have strung 30 passes on you, you start getting fucking pissed.
Yeah.
And I've seen players, like young players, like 8 or 9, and their teammates are just clowning on them, or like 30, 40 passes. And these kids are soft, right? So they start, bro, they literally start crying, bro. They're like, fuck you guys. You're fucking cheating, you know? But yeah, think about it. If you're Madrid and Barca's fucking smashing at 5-0 and you can't even get near the ball, dude, you're going to be pissed, bro.
No, I want to find that clip now. See if we can inject it here.
Is that the one where like Messi gets subbed off and he's walking off the field and like Ronaldo's looking at him pissed, and then you see the score like 5-0?
Well, that was the 5-0 game. I just don't remember if that was the game when that sequence that I'm describing happened.
Yeah. We'll have to do some research onto that one. Mm. All right. I like it. So, Gary, I know we've talked a lot about the press, and this is a pressing episode, but on the opposite side of it, how do you train beating the press, right? If you're facing a team that, let's say a team is extremely organized in the way that they're pressing, okay? Everything's orchestrated. All the players are in the right movements. Like when you guys would face teams like that, was it like, fuck, let's try and play a little bit more direct? And even when I say direct, I don't mean just launching it forward, but I mean getting it to the 9 feet or spraying it to the winger. Like, even I know even those moments were choreographed. So is that the adjustment? It's like, fuck, these guys are pressing us like animals. We're struggling to get out. Here's my two questions. How do you get out of those moments? And in those moments, was it like, all right, let's make the adjustment. Let's just be a little bit more direct too.
Yeah, it's not that difficult actually to play out when they're pressing you, if you've rehearsed it, number one. But obviously, number two, you had to have, you know, players that are technically proficient to the level that's required, right? So, and how do you get that? You get that from the rondos, ladies and gentlemen. Oh, rondos aren't directional. Yeah, they give you the skill to be able to do directional things like we're describing now. So in the rondos, Benny, obviously, balls are flying all over the place on the ground, fast passes, 1-2 touch maximum. So if somebody's pressing you in the rondos, so it's just like on the training grounds. Oh, the other team is pressing you? Cool, no problem. I don't feel the pressure. I can play out. But you can only play out if it is choreographed to play out, because like you said, if the other team is very organized, then you're going to have a guy right on your back before you even get a ball. And so, yeah, you need to have maybe 2 or 3 patterns that usually end up being more direct, because if they are high pressing you, guess where all the space is? All the space is at their backs. So it is 1 or 2 passes and already the 9 has it at his feet, right? Or the 9 is laying it off to a center mid, off his chest, or off one touch off his foot. But you have to train it. And again, if you're technically proficient, it's easier to play out if they're pressing you because they're committing to you. Hey, you can't make a mistake because if you make a mistake, obviously there's a big problem on your hands. But if you don't make a mistake, it's the best thing ever because you have so much space now and you're lethal.
Yeah, that's true. That's why, Gary, though, it's harder at the younger ages to, because dude, a lot of teams don't have center backs that can spray a 20-30 yard ball, right? And so when a team when a team high presses you, it's basically like you're fucked, you know, because you can't go direct. If you do go direct, you're probably just giving it to their 10 or their winger and they just go straight to goal, you know. So that's why I think at the younger ages is even more important to rehearse the building out of the back on the floor, like short passes, because that's just, to be honest, dude, like many kids can't. Okay, there are some exceptions, Gary, where like there was a kid on my team when I was 8 that this fool could score a goal from the kickoff, right? And this fool, he would be our center back and he was able to launch it forward. But most teams don't have that, you know? Yeah. And so if you're not rehearsing, hey, how are we going to get out of the high press situation? Then you're pretty fucked, dude.
That also just confirms, in my opinion, what I earlier said. Yeah, that actually it doesn't, because I was going to say about not really focusing in on pressing at those earliest of ages, because it's not the most important thing. But you were saying how if it's done to you, you know, what are you going to do about it?
Yeah, exactly. Gary, are there any, I mean, in the recent like highly competitive games that you watch, let's say whether it be Champions League or at the national level, because I know you still watch games, what are the top teams right now that when you look at them, it's like, wow, this team is by far the best pressing team that I see? Are there any that come to mind for people to go and watch?
Oh, no, man. I've scaled back a lot of my watching, honestly. So it's hard for me to say currently who that would be.
Or like even in the last World Cup, like I know you watched a lot of the games. What was the best team that you saw? I feel like Chile is really good with their press.
Yeah, but Chile is shocking now. I think if they didn't come in last place, they came in second to last place in South America. They aren't even going to the World Cup. God, man, that's a tough question, dude. That's a tough question. I was going to say Argentina, but I don't think that's really true. Brazil definitely is shockingly bad at pressing. If they ever try to press, they most of the time they don't even try to press. Let's see, North America, Mexico sucks my balls. You know, honest to God, truth, you know, Pochettino's United States men's national team. Hey, be up. No, I'm not even kidding you. I'm not even kidding you, Benny. Overseas in Europe. Ben, I swear to God, I think that might be my recommendation. Watch Pochettino's press. And oh, bro, you know they're playing Uruguay. So you have a chance to see Bielsa in action. So I'm going to assume that Uruguay is going to press like a mother effer. Let's see what happens. That is a game to watch, everybody. Uruguay versus the U.S. men's national team. Ben, we have to publish this before then. When's that game? Is that game on Saturday? When is it? Or Sunday?
You check.
Is that the first game?
It is. No, it's on Tuesday.
Okay, November Tuesday 18th. Of next week. All right, we have to get this episode out.
On Monday.
Monday morning, episode's got to be out. And this will be the teaser.
I'm shocked.
This is, if you want to learn about pressing, you watch the U.S. men's national team.
But do you think Pochettino will recognize, like, all right, fucking Uruguay is better than us, we're going to sit back a little bit? Or do you think he's going to go out and say, fuck it, let's high press him?
It's a great question, Benny. That's why I want to watch it now.
I'm shocked, Gary, because it's very rare when you mention something good about the U.S. men's team. So credit to Pochettino.
Yeah, it's all about it. It's so weird, dude. The world is backwards. Now everybody is talking shit on Pochettino when they should be praising the guy. It's weird. And they praise the coach like a Berhalter or whatever back in the day when they should be annihilating him. Or they should be praising Klinsmann, but they're annihilating him. It's a wacky world, man.
Have you been watching any of the MLS playoffs or no? You don't give a fuck?
No. No.
You're notorious and you're on record saying that, you know, you do watch a lot of MLS. So I was just curious.
Benny, I have watched more MLS games than the people who cover MLS. Yes. But now I have not really interested. It's not that, it's just, it never really was that interesting, but for some reason this year in particular, and especially the playoffs, snooze fest. Who gives a fuck? Benny, they made, you know this, right? They made a 3-game series. They're trying to make it like basketball or baseball or whatever, or the best of three. What the fuck are you, what is going on?
So dumb.
Dumbest shit ever.
Yeah, dude, that's crazy. Last thing on Preston Gary, or actually two more things. I know in the early days, right, TFA, even the Rage, Brian didn't really have access to like classroom setting type environment, right? Meaning that when he got to the Galaxy or even with Chivas, were there more times when you guys would go in and sit down and Brian would be on the whiteboard and say, all right, this is exactly where you need to be defensively. These are the movements. These are the rotations. Was a lot of time spent in the classroom, Gary, or not really? It was more on the field. Because even within the platform, you see, I think when you guys are in Spain for Mick Cup, right, you see him before one of the games. It's like a small little, I don't know, it was in the hotel or something. And you see Brian with the big notepad and he's talking about the game. Did that happen a lot, Gary? Or was that just kind of a before the game thing? Because nowadays you see a lot of like teams in the classroom, especially at the academy. It's like, oh, we're going to spend, you know, an hour or two on the whiteboard watching film or with the tactic board. You know what I mean?
Before then, not a lot at all, Benny. No. One of my earliest memories is because we didn't have facilities, Ben.
Yeah.
Right. To actually do that. So one of my earliest memories is when we took the whole team to the university, you know, where I teach, and I just cracked open a classroom at the university and we had a overhead projector and we would do stuff there. But that was like a few times max. And it was with the little kids too. It was like with the famous U11 team. And then after that, obviously Brian went to Chivas USA, went to MLS. And you know, that's a different story at that point. But before, no, not really, Benny. Do you remember anything when you were playing with Brian? It was only like whiteboards on the field, but not classroom setting.
Yeah, no, we never had a class. I think the only time we did one thing was we went to one of the players' house and we just watched film of the game and Brian was there kind of breaking it down. But other than that, yeah, no, I don't remember much of it.
Yeah. Well, nowadays with technology, I mean, you literally... But see, the problem is you need a platform. You need somebody kind of dedicated to doing it. You could, as a coach, like cut things and then even record yourself giving a lesson and then publishing the video for everybody to watch on your team. But that's a lot of work. And I don't expect coaches to do that. Coaches get paid peanuts. They're underappreciated. And that's just ridiculous to have as an expectation for them.
Yeah, for sure. I've seen a lot too, Gary. Especially now at the pro game, like on the sideline, you'll see the coaches on their iPad or like a play happens and then the assistant brings the iPad over to Pep and they're breaking it down. I'm wondering what their halftimes look like at the pro level. Is it like they have all these? Because I saw something recently about the Celtics coach and he was like, all right, somebody asked him, like, what does your halftime look like? He's like, well, we go in, it's 15 minutes. We clip together like 4 moments of offense, 4 moments of defense, and we break it down. Right. Obviously now with technology, that's a possibility, but I'm wondering if that happens at the pro level too, to where it's like, hey, look at how they're pressing us or look at how we're pressing and they're getting out. So let's make this little adjustment here.
It does. There's a pretty well-known clip. Oh, I don't know if it's well-known actually. I think it was Luis Enrique saying that, you know, him or his assistants throughout the match, they'll be on, not the walkie-talkie, they'll be, yeah, something like a walkie-talkie or in communication with their video editor team in the back. While the game is happening, they'll be like, clip that, clip, you know, Vitinha just, you know, doing this and doing that right now. Oh, clip that moment, clip that moment. So by the time halftime rolls around, there's a set of all the moments that they wanted to capture during the match. And then they're already well prepared. Not a minute is wasted.
Yeah. You're gonna see fucking, you know, the youth teams that are like 8 years old and they have a fucking video from like, what are you guys doing? The game is like absolutely shocking. And the funny thing is, Gary, I think a lot of those teams record the games and they never watch it, bro. They never watch. The parents pay $200 each for the season, and they get the tripod set up every game, and the kids are 7 years old, bro. And then nobody watches the film. But watch, you're going to start seeing like coaches with iPads at halftime at the youth level, sir.
Man, so wild. We were among the first then to do that stuff. And we were also the first, I think, I've never seen anything to use a drone as well. Like drones had barely come around. They're like, what the fuck is that? That people were like shocked to even see this flying thing overhead.
Yeah. I think the iPod tower that you got, the camera, I think it was for like American football, no? The
one that you totally. Bought.
And it had never been used for soccer before.
Totally.
But think about it, dude. The guys at Veo or Trace, they saw you and they made it into a multi-million-dollar business.
Yeah, I've been thinking about maybe fooling around with developing our own camera system, because I've seen when people post the Veo and the Trace stuff, it's really bad. I don't know if you agree. Maybe you disagree with me. It's so bad. And I understand it. It's because without a human operator, they don't know how they're supposed to be filming. There's an art to filming, especially if you want to film it from a perspective that a coach would find useful, right? That's a certain type of filming, or from a perspective that would be highly entertaining, you know, for action and stuff. That's a different type of filming that you have to do. But the automated stuff, so bad, so bad. I'm wondering if the technology is there at this point to the degree where you can leverage it and actually have it train on, say, professionally, humanly filmed matches. And then it'll be like, okay, I get it. I know how I need to film this match.
AI, bro.
Yeah, for sure. I just don't know if the technology is there quite yet to be able to do all that image recognition.
All right, Gary, last thing. And this is something that we've gone away from, but I want to start bringing it back again. Promotion relegation. How does it tie into our topic of today? And by the way, before I saw the stupidest comment, I forget if it was on YouTube or Instagram, but somebody was saying like, oh, like, shut the fuck up, Gary, about promotion relegation. Like the second and third tier here is shocking. And there's no way it'll ever be able to support a promotion relegation system. So I don't know where these people get it from, man.
Yeah.
Sorry to bring that up.
I kind of know, but I don't want to derail us, but I do want to address that since you brought it up, it can't go unanswered. The second division in the United States, the USL Championship, is probably one of the best second divisions there is in the world, insofar as infrastructure is concerned, insofar as, I mean, you name it, fields, organization, even, you know, salaries. You're not going to get rich playing the USL Championship, but okay, you can probably make anywhere from, say, $3,000 a month to $12,000 a month. And I just don't think folks understand what a second division around the world actually looks like, and what those salaries look like, and what the infrastructure of those things look like, and what the crowds look like. The crowds here in our second division are incredible relative to the rest of the world, Ben. And even our third division with USL League One, same thing goes there. So from the sporting perspective, they're more than equipped. From an economics perspective, I think what almost everybody misses, especially people who live paycheck to paycheck or on a salary and don't really have a lot of money, so they don't really interface with the economy really, you know, as like a business person. So they're too busy with their lives to really go deep dive and understand how the world works. If you open it up to promotion relegation, it doesn't have to be, it's not necessarily going to be the same club owners in the second division here and the third division here who are going to put in the money and invest and try to get to the first division. It'll be the billionaires will show up and the corporations will show up and they will start operating clubs in the second and third tier. And they have as deep a pockets as you want. So they'll build out whatever infrastructure they deem is necessary. And if they do win and get promoted to MLS, they'll have more than enough resources to satisfy the competition level, be it in getting players, being in building out the staff, the employees, be it in upgrading stadiums, be it in travel, you name it, money's not an object, especially in this country, Benny. But folks here are stuck with the vision that however they freeze the world. However they see the world now, that's just how it is, and it doesn't change. They don't understand the dynamics that occur once you change a regulation or you change an incentive, how the entire world that they have seen for the past 5, 10, 15, 30 years changes. All of it changes. So of course we're ready, man. It's just stupendous signal. It's very frustrating. I think a lot of it has to do with the brainwashing that's existed. Anyway, okay, you wanted to say how does the pressing stuff tie into promotion relegation? Benny, I mean, what else is there to say? Promotion relegation is all about a meritocracy. So whoever learns how to press the best is going to advance their cause. Whoever learns how to break the press of the opponent the best, it's going to advance their cause. And guess what? They're going to be incentivized to learn those two facets of the game, because if you do not learn those two facets of the game, you are going to lose and you are going to be relegated and you will have no chance of getting promoted. So everybody's incentives are aligned. And if you're teaching this stuff because you have to, because you're incented to, awesome. Your players are going to learn even more, Benny, and have even more capabilities and more development.
I know the answer, Gary. I just like seeing you getting passionate and riled up about
it. Yeah, yeah. No, man. Dude, I got to tell you, these are interesting times we're living through.
Why do you say that?
No, because it seems like we have a whole yin and yang, good versus evil thing. I don't know if it's all by design for the country to be at each other's throats, where 50% of the country thinks the other 50% of the country is, I don't know, scum. But that's what we're living through, Ben. And we're at each other's throats, and I don't know how it's all going to play out. And it's very sad, honestly, to see. I don't have the solution. I do have an opinion. I do have a perspective, like most people do. I don't know. I'll leave it there, man. But the struggle exists at a national scale, just like it exists in the microcosm that is the business of soccer. And yes, soccer is not just a game. It is a proxy for the expression of our political, social, economic, and cultural values, Ben.
Let's see how it all plays out, Gary. We're living in one of the most fascinating times ever of human history.
Ever, man. Look, your background, you're at Cal State Fullerton State University, graduating thousands of people every year. And I don't know what these students are going to do, because the job market is not great. And it's not a consequence of this party or that party necessarily. It's just the consequence of the entire state that we're in. And this has been something that's been developing for years, decades even. So I don't know what they're going to do, especially with AI taking over a lot of the jobs that used to exist. And it's going to continue taking more and more jobs. So you're studying, you're graduating, you think you're going to get a job doing X, Y, and Z, making X, Y, and Z, and you're going to have this sort of life, and it just ain't true. Weird. I need to go buy more weapons, Benny. I need to prep. I need to become a prepper. I need to go get a cabin in the woods somewhere and take all my arsenal with me and, I don't know, live off the land.
You need a... But she really needs a doomsday bunker, bro. All right, Dave. Let's end it there before we get too off the rails here.
All right, Benny. Well, that's it for today, guys. Thank you for listening. A reminder for coaches. You can get both the free and premium coaching programs at 343coaching.com. Don't let anyone tell you your teams can't win by playing dominant, possession-based football. while also developing individual players to the highest levels. Nonsense. We've proved it at every single level, and so have hundreds of serious member coaches across the country. Now that we've moved on to the pro level, we're delivering everything we've learned in the program. Don't wait and continue delaying getting on a proven path. And parents, 343masterclass.com is where you want to go to get a working compass for navigating the American soccer landscape with your player. It's pretty bad out there, but let our experience guide you. Lastly, if you're coaching 7v7, we've got you covered there as well. Go to 7v7coaching.com. Until next time, cheers everyone, and keep building.